Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, December 10th, 2015. Your humble host is burdened with too many opinions. And now, I've been polled, so my opinion counts. And she says, I wish that I could be like the cool kids, because all the cool kids, they seem to fit in. I wish that I could be like the cool kids. And there's a fascinating new poll out of millennials, the 18 to 29-year-olds today. But first, I want to mention that I was a little surprised. The phone rang here at the Secret Studio late on Tuesday afternoon, and a young woman said, would you like to participate in a Pew opinion poll? And PEW, Pew, is one of the respected national polling operations. And so I said, well, gosh, how long does this take? And she said, oh, 7 minutes. Well, she lied. It took about 20 minutes. And I was fascinated to hear what the questions are. Because I have worked with pollsters to design the questions that are used in political campaigns to try to suss out what voters care about, how much they know, and those sorts of things. And I was really floored by the tone of the questions that the Pew poll was putting to me and other respondents. I imagine 600 to 900 people across the country will experience the same thing that I did. And the questions, it's always a squirm, right? Because some of them are yes or no, and some of them are you somewhat agree, or you definitely agree, or you definitely don't agree. In any event, the way the questions are framed is really essential to the output of a poll. And so repeatedly the questions were, is President Obama tough enough or too tough on the Islamic State? But there was no opportunity for me to offer my point of view that we don't belong in the fight against Daesh or ISIS to begin with, and that our policies in Syria are incoherent, misguided, irrational, and don't have an end game. There was no way for me to express those views. And so these questions kept coming, which tried to, you know, put me into a pigeonhole. You support Trump, you think he's a lunatic. And there is no middle ground in the way these questions are posed. And I expressed my frustration to the woman who was conducting the call. And these are people who get $12 or $15 an hour to sit in a call center, in a cubicle, and read these questions to strangers and just hope that they'll answer them and get this thing over with so she can go home. And they encounter all kinds of hostility because they call at dinner time and interrupt people. So, you know, I have sympathy for the people who collect the data, who actually make those phone calls. But I have a real problem with the way Pew is characterizing its questions in a way that reflects the worst that's going on in our nation today, the whole Trump factor. And so that, definitely that virus will infect the results, and next week we'll see the results of a Pew poll, and I'll be very curious to see how my answers stacked up with those of other people. But there's a new NPR poll out today that is a fascinating look at millennials, people aged 18 to 29. And what is really stunning is that 60% of the young people who participated in this poll said that they support deploying U.S. ground troops to fight the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. But even more of them, 62%, say they definitely wouldn't be those boots on the ground. They would not join the fight. And another 23%, totaling 85% of the millennials, say that they probably would not join the fight. And 15% say they've already joined, are considering joining the military for this this struggle. So that is a very interesting result. And to some extent, it does seem to reflect the distrust that this age cohort has for government in general. Now, the poll also shows that 43% of young Americans polled welcome the idea of building a wall, a beautiful wall that Donald Trump describes along the U.S. border with Mexico. but only 31% of Democrats in the group support that position. So it's clear that that is a party line issue that, well, goes as deep as the youngest voters here in the United States. But the real surprise in this poll is the skyrocketing support for Bernie Sanders. The poll was conducted 6 months ago, and Sanders showed 1% of young Democratic primary voters supporting him, and now he is beating Hillary Clinton 41% to 35%. And the pollster Della Volpe is quoted as saying, "The idea of any candidate moving 40 points or so over the course of 6 months is extraordinary." And among young Republicans, Trump has just a 2-point lead over Ben Carson, and that's within the margin of error. The other interesting factor here is that these young people are not put off by Bernie Sanders being labeled, or his self-description, of being a Democratic socialist. It makes no difference to 66% of likely Democratic voters who are described by Della Volpe as fiercely independent. They're not looking at a label. They're looking at a person and his platform. And in some cases, 24% say that the Sanders tag as Democratic Socialist makes them more likely to support him. Of course, the question is, will these young voters turn out next November? Will they turn out in the primaries and show their stronger support for Sanders over Clinton? And that so far is unknown. The final thing from this poll shows that young people don't really follow the news and political news very much at all. About 58% say they follow politics not very closely or not at all closely, and 40% say that they follow it very closely or somewhat closely. A slightly larger margin is paying attention to the 2016 presidential race. Another poll out today from the New York Times and CBS News shows that Donald Trump has the strongest lead in the Republican primary. Ben Carson is ebbing down to 13%, Trump at 35%, Ted Cruz on a surge. He's quadrupled his share in the last few weeks to 16%. And Marco Rubio is running, fourth in this poll with 9%. And the rest of the Republicans don't even break the margin of error at 4%. 64% of Republicans say it is too early to be sure who their nominee will be. And this is a very interesting metric here. 24% of voters expressed concern, and 40% said they have fear about what Trump would do if elected president. But that is mirrored when the pollsters ask about Hillary Clinton. Only 1-point difference. 23% say they are concerned about a Hillary Clinton presidency, and 34%, compared to Trump's 40%, say that they're scared about the possibility of a Clinton presidency. So this shows the extreme polarization in American politics, and that many of us who would be categorized by the pollsters as Democratic or Democratic-leaning, I told Pew I'm an independent, which I am, it shows that many of us have misgivings about Hillary Clinton to the point that many of us fear what would happen if she is elected president. Now, with this snapshot of American attitudes at this moment, where fear and hysteria and the exaggerated risk of the Islamic State are all being propelled into media messages and people are dealing with that, well, in Tuesday's paper, The New York Times, Rukmini Kalamachi wrote an interesting piece that is billed as analysis. And it's fascinating because what she basically says is that the bellicose, belligerent, and bigoted Americans who want to race headlong into carpet bombing, as Ted Cruz calls it, the Islamic State, are falling into the trap that has been set by the Islamic State, by Daesh. And this is a replay of the hysteria that led us into Iraq back in 2003. And it is amazing to see how easily manipulated the American people are. But Kalamachi writes that the Islamic State hopes that we will bring on what they called in Iraq the Blessed Invasion. And they would not only be able to declare their prophecy fulfilled, but they could also turn the occurrence into a new recruiting drive. Because to hear Donald Trump announce that America is closing its borders to all Muslims is so offensive to the world of Islam that it drives people into the arms of extremists. Because if we are perceived as the enemy, then many people who think in black and white terms will be drawn to the other side. And so the Islamic State's propaganda is filled with references to apocalyptic prophecy about the last great battle that sets the stage for the end times. The specific scripture they refer to describes a battle in the Syrian town of Dabiq, as well as in a town called Al-Amak. And the countdown to apocalypse begins once the Romans, a term that militants have now conveniently expanded to include Americans and their allies, set foot in Dabiq. So this is what they want us to do. And they know, in a calculated manner, that it's easy to manipulate the United States, the superpower with all the bombs and drones and nuclear weapons, into falling into this trap and doing it again. I've linked to the analysis piece, and I hope you'll read it. Also, we're seeing that the Pentagon wants to exploit the current hysteria by expanding its huge footprint of military bases even further. People like the late Chalmers Johnson showed how we have more than 900 active military bases around the world. And while we claim this is a network that keeps us safe, it projects American militarism in ways that do not help us in so many respects. And so the military wants new bases in Africa, Southwest Asia, the Middle East. And they claim that it's because of the franchises of the Islamic State, at least 8 militant groups that have pledged loyalty to the network's leaders. But as you know, I'm highly skeptical of the real meaning of these networks and affiliations. And for example, we know that our intelligence agencies believe that there was no command that came from Raqqa in Syria for affiliates of the Islamic State to take out the Russian airliner a few weeks back. Likewise, we know there was no order from Raqqa to the couple in San Bernardino. But we don't let facts like that get in the way of an opportunity to expand American military operations. Now, buried in this article in the New York Times, it notes the plan has met with some resistance from State Department officials concerned about a more permanent military presence across Africa and the Middle East. Career diplomats have long warned about the creeping militarization of American foreign policy as the Pentagon has forged new relationships with foreign governments eager for military aid. And Ashton Carter is proposing nodes in Spain, in Afghanistan, in Niger, in Cameroon, and in Iraq. They are targeting Erbil in northern Iraq. Now, I thought we left Iraq, and I know we're back, but to put a permanent or so-called enduring base in Erbil just sounds pretty crazy. And late in the article, once again, they raise questions about the real meaning and whatever threat is posed by the Islamic State through these affiliates. And citing an unnamed, anonymous American intelligence official who is quoted as saying that the Islamic State does not vet the new affiliates with the same scrutiny that Al-Qaeda does and generally welcomes any opportunity to build its global brand. The affiliates are a melange of different identities and agendas, and some might not be completely subsumed into the Islamic State. They are flying the Islamic State flag, he said, in an attempt to elevate their cause. And also to fool the United States. We are easily fooled. We set ourselves up for it. The demagogues take the stage, talk about the need for extreme action. And in today's New York Times, Roger Cohen uses some heart-wrenching anecdotes about people who've been victimized by the Islamic State and basically concludes that we have no choice but to jump into this trap. I hope cooler minds will prevail. Yesterday was a pivot point of sorts in Syria, as hundreds of people were evacuated from Homs, the central Syrian city that has been devastated by years of bitter fighting and a siege that has been underway for several years now. Basically, the government won. The Assad forces have prevailed, and those who have left are part of the Nusra Front, the Syrian affiliate linked to Al-Qaeda. And the Obama administration is hoping that these kinds of ceasefires, such as they are, that don't involve the battle with the Islamic State, could change the landscape in Syria. Me? I'm not so sure. Now we learn that the guns that we sent to Iraq have been turned against us. Amnesty International has just released a new report showing that the Islamic State has used weapons from more than 25 different countries, including the U.S., to wage its military campaign in Iraq and Syria. And part of this is the result of our effort to arm the moderates in these different conflicts. And when the moderates are overrun by the extremists, they pick up our weapons and all those beautiful Toyota trucks that you see Daesh running convoys with across Syria and Iraq. The U.S. sold billions of dollars worth of tanks, aircraft, and missile units to Iraq. In 2014, the estimate is that the country got more than $500 million in small arms and ammunition from the U.S. Since the invasion, so over a 10 or 11-year period. The U.S. and its coalition partners sent more than 1 million infantry weapons and pistols with millions of rounds of ammunition. And not only that, there are some more sophisticated weapons, including sniper rifles and anti-tank missiles made by Russia, Chinese, and European manufacturers. So this is a trend where, once again, we think that we are staying out of a conflict by arming various fighters, and ultimately those weapons are turned against us. Every day I like to pause and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Folks like Annette McManus, Andy Krieger, Richard Knight just renewed his annual subscription, and Joe Whistleblower Carson out in Tennessee is a monthly subscriber as well. I'd like to invite you to join them. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the tab that says Menu on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage, and that gives you a menu where you choose Become a Subscriber. From there, you can pick $10, $5, $20 a month, the $50 annual subscription. You can mail in a check or cash or a money order for any amount, or you can conduct that transaction via PayPal. However you do it, I appreciate your support of the PBC podcast. And speaking of podcasts, last year the NPR Serial podcast was a real blockbuster, and I really appreciate that it brought a whole new generation, a whole new swath of people into the world of podcasting. People found out, hey, I can listen to that on my phone. Isn't that cool? Well, the second season of Serial is out, and they're focusing on the issue of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. And he, of course, as you know, disappeared from his unit in a province of Afghanistan back in 2009. And many people believe he's a traitor, that he deserted his unit. But the Serial is going to investigate this and bring you, I think, an in-depth look at it. And already I'm seeing excerpts here of Bergdahl being permitted to tell his side of the story. And he basically says he's a whistleblower, that the only way to get attention was to become a missing soldier so the top officials could no longer ignore his concerns and would be forced to investigate the situation. But he also admits to Sarah Koenig that his actions were driven in part by a desire to prove a point or execute a personal mission of sorts. He wanted to be a Jason Bourne-type hero. And Then he ended up in captivity, and we swapped 5 Guantanamo prisoners for Bo Bergdahl. Today I'm releasing an in-depth interview with Stephen Hill to subscribers of the Peter B. Collins podcast. Stephen Hill is a fascinating guy. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation. He lives in San Francisco. And his new book is called Raw Deal: How the Uber Economy and Runaway Capitalism Are Screwing American Workers. And it's a brilliant takedown of Uber, of Lyft, of Airbnb, and these companies that purport to be good for average people. Oh, like the Uber driver who gets to be his own CEO as the company tries to spin it. Well, today we learned that a federal judge has expanded dramatically the scope of a class action suit brought by Uber drivers in California. And their primary goal is to be reclassified from independent contractor to employees of the company. And if that happens, it'll be a sharp hit to the Uber business model, which shifts all of those costs, as Stephen Hill explains in our interview and in his book, to the drivers. And Uber has cut compensation to drivers twice to the point where it's very hard for them to make a living behind the wheel these days. In addition, Stephen Hill explains the politics of Uber, which has hired David Plouffe, one of the political advisors to the Obama campaign, and he is now the political director at Uber. And the flashpoint, as Hill describes it, is in Seattle, where there is a showdown between Uber and organized labor. And David Plouffe is trying to push the Democratic Party into the Uber camp and away from the collective bargaining unions. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Stephen Hill.
You know, in Seattle, there's actually an attempt now. There's a bill that's been introduced at the Seattle City Council level that's going to be voted on fairly soon. That would create a form of collective bargaining for Uber drivers, because as contractors, the law doesn't allow them to actually form a union. So it's going to allow basically NGO-type nonprofits to organize these drivers. Now, here's the interesting thing about that. Going up to Seattle to speak against this proposal is David Plouffe, the former campaign manager for Barack Obama in 2008. He's a brilliant campaign strategist. He designed the strategy to beat back the attempt by Mayor Bill de Blasio in New York to crack down on Uber because it was creating so much congestion there. And he's doing that by reaching into the establishment of the Democratic Party and using the Democratic Party to protect Uber. And in the case of Seattle, what he's going to be speaking against is a collective bargaining bill, which the Democratic Party, at least in rhetoric, has always said, we're pro-labor, we're right in favor of collective bargaining. So, and this is happening in the middle of a presidential election year where Hillary Clinton has been trying to strike a fine balance between saying, on the one hand, we need good jobs, and implying that Uber and these other technology companies are not good jobs, but also mindful that a lot of the young urban Democratic-leaning voters like their Uber. So Hillary's been trying to strike this sweet spot balance. But now Plouffe is coming along and pushing the Democratic Party to basically be against this type of collective bargaining for Uber drivers. So really, this is going to be about the soul of the Democratic Party that I think is going to play out in this presidential election.
You can hear the full conversation with Stephen Hill. It's released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, at TuneIn, at iTunes, and at Stitcher, or anywhere else you find the PBC podcast. Well, I never thought this would happen, but Ted Cruz and I are in agreement on at least one point. The Texas senator, who is running now close behind Donald Trump in the Republican polls for president, has rejected calls from many in his own party who believe that the recent attacks are grounds for a return to the controversial bulk data collection techniques, the massive sweeping up of our telephone records by the NSA. And I give Ted Cruz credit for clear thinking, at least for a minute here. He says, you know, there are some who have called for resurrecting the government bulk data collection that existed under the Patriot Act, but more data from millions of law-abiding Americans is not always better data. Hoarding tens of billions of records of ordinary citizens didn't stop Fort Hood, didn't stop Boston, Chattanooga, Garland, or the San Bernardino plotters.
And so while, you know, this is an expedient point of agreement between me and Ted Cruz, I'll take it. Because we're not hearing any Democrats right now stand up and say we don't need to resume the dragnet collection of Americans' phone records. And the whining that is coming out of law enforcement is really silly, because they have access to phone records in the same manner they did before. They're just held in a different set of files at a phone company. And so it's an extra couple of clicks for the NSA or the FBI to grab our phone call information. Well, I'm sorry to report that hate is alive and well here in sunny California. Two incidents in recent days. Over the weekend, a woman who works for the State Department of Corrections, she is not a prison guard, but she works in the parole program. Her name is Denise Slater, and she was at a park in the San Francisco East Bay suburbs, Lake Chabot Regional Park. And apparently she saw a couple of men who appeared to be Muslims to her who were praying. So one of them started to talk with her, and she started yelling. She yelled, "Your God is Satan. Allah is Satan. The Quran is evil." And then when another man began shooting video of this confrontation, this woman Slater hit him with an umbrella and then threw coffee on him. And he is quoted by the San Francisco Chronicle, "After praying, this lady approached us and started yelling at us that we're brainwashed for believing in Allah. Allah is evil," she said. "Well, I started videotaping her. I also was hit by an umbrella before taking a shower of coffee right in my face." Slater went on to say, "The people you tortured are going to be in eternity in heaven. You are very deceived by Satan. Your mind has taken over, brainwashed. You have nothing but hate, nothing but hate." So this is an ugly and ignorant expression. These people even tried to tell her that they like Jesus to try to defuse the situation, but she was unmoved. And so that's one of those scenes. Also, a bunch of idiots who can't spell and don't know the difference between a Muslim and a Sikh vandalized a Sikh temple in Orange County on Sunday. This was in Buena Park at the Gurdwara Singh Sabha. And the people who vandalized the place misspelled Islam. The graffiti, much of it illegible, also included some gang references. And Sikhs have often been mistaken by angry and ignorant Americans for Muslims. In September, a Sikh man was attacked and badly beaten by a suspect who pulled up to his car yelling racial slurs. And finally today, as the Paris Climate Change Conference reaches its climax, it's supposed to wind down over the next day or so, and we're told they're very close to an agreement, we get some good news. China's dramatic rise in renewable energy use has helped cause global greenhouse gas emissions from fossil fuels to slow down for the first time in nearly 15 years. And when the final numbers are in for 2015, it could show a modest decline. According to Stanford University researcher Robert Jackson, our data provides a small glimmer of hope that the steady growth of heat-trapping carbon dioxide in the atmosphere may be ending. And this modest leveling of the rate of increase is good news. And it shows that human efforts to limit the impact of human behavior on the climate are having some measurable impact. It's fascinating because I first heard Rush Limbaugh describe this in a completely different way. He said that, oh, the scientists, the, you know, global warming nuts, they're all up in arms because the data shows that global warming is declining. Well, it's declining because people are taking action and because we're changing the energy mix. But the Neanderthals want to believe that this is some sort of a plot to disguise information that is inconvenient to scientists who embrace climate change and the human causes of it. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment. You're free to share this podcast with absolutely everyone. So get started. Put it up on Facebook. Click the like button. Share it. You know what to do. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.